This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Hi, welcome to the National Museum of Australia. It's great to see such a turnout for this, our first presentation, this new series, a public conversation on historical imagination. My name's Helena, I'm a senior program coordinator here at the National Museum. And this is a really interesting new series that we've started. I don't know how many of you actually know what we're actually going to be talking about here today. Historical imagination. What does that mean? Well, actually, it was the brainchild of a number of people together here at the institution, one of which is sitting up the back there, Kirsten Wiener, one of our senior curators here, who actually was interested in looking at how history and historical research actually inspired and informed the work of artists, i.e. writers, playwrights, poets, painters, sculptors, musicians. So this is the first in our series, which is basically an informal conversation between, we have very lucky to have today, we have Peter Stanley, the head of our research centre, we have Frank Morehouse, the writer who you're all familiar with, and we have Leonore, who's a historian. So we have this lovely mix of different people who will explore this terrain. Now, I'm not going to give in-depth, detailed introduction to these different people. I'm going to hand it over to our facilitator today, who's very generously agreed to do this, and that's Dr. Peter Stanley. So without any more ado, let's begin.
Thanks, Helena. Well, hello, everybody. Friends, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the National Museum of Australia. This is the first, as Helena says, of the series of conversations about the historical imagination, in which, as she says, writers of history join with writers of historical fiction to explore where their arts meet and where they diverge in practice, on the page, and in the minds of their readers. But before we start that conversation, can I remind you all to turn off your mobile phones? And those in the back row have a particular responsibility. If you can't hear, please wave at me in a very obvious fashion, and we'll take account of that. Now, I'm delighted this afternoon to be here to introduce two practitioners of those different approaches towards our understanding of the past, Dr. Leonore Coulthart and Frank Morehouse, and I'll introduce both of them presently. What will we do this afternoon? Well, first of all, Frank will speak about fiction and history, then Leonore will speak about mostly history, then I'll attempt to do a Parkinson, but without the Yorkshire accent and the mumbles, and facilitate an open conversation, my running sheet says, between Frank and Leonore. And then we'll open the conversation up to you. So please, I hope you'll take notes and be able to chip in about half an hour's time to start this open discussion about the relationship between history and fiction, two subjects which I know I certainly share a great interest in, and I'm pretty sure you do because of your presence here this afternoon. Can I remind you that our proceedings will be podcast and broadcast on the museum's excellent website, and we have technicians standing by in all parts of the room with microphones and other technical gear. So, today is a special occasion for me because it was just 3 months yesterday that I commenced to work at this wonderful institution to run the Centre for Historical Research. And one of the great pleasures of working in this place is that we come into contact with visitors who come to the museum, both visitors like yourselves, but also visitors like Frank, whom we've invited to come in and work with us. And one of my pleasures this afternoon is to introduce a man whom I met very shortly after I arrived, and I'm now pleased to introduce to you. Frank Morehouse is a distinguished Australian man of letters. He's the author of many novels and collections of short stories, and I'm sure you know them yourselves. Some of these works he's turned into screen productions, The American's Baby, The Coca-Cola Kid, The Everlasting Secret Family. He's written a couple of volumes of memoirs, Days of Wine and Rage, and Martini. But the particular reason that he's here this afternoon and the reason he's at the museum in the last couple of months is because of two novels he's published. Grand Days, which appeared in 1993, and if you are looking for the ACT Library's copy, I'm sorry, it's overdue and it's in my name. And also the sequel, Dark Palace, which appeared in 2000. Now, I'd like to quote a little from Dark Palace before Frank gets a chance to talk to you, because the note to readers in the front of Dark Palace very much informs our discussion about the relationship between history and fiction today. Frank gave a note to the reader. I hope you weren't going to quote this yourself, Frank, but let me do it for you. This book is in part, he says, based on dramatic reconstruction of real people, identified by their actual names. and on fictional characters who sometimes embody features of people who existed at the time, but who are essentially fictional. Where people who actually existed say anything substantial, their words are taken from documentary sources or are constructed within the context of existing evidence. All the substantial events depicted, and quite a few of the insubstantial events, are inspired by documentary sources. But the book is, above all, a work of the imagination. And there you have the whole essence of this series expressed in this note. And one of the things that's impressed me about Frank is just how seriously he takes history. He's not someone who whizzes in, reads a couple of newspapers, and then makes it all up. It's very strongly grounded in the actuality. Well, as I say, Frank was awarded a visiting fellowship at the Centre for Historical Research this year, and he's about to give us one of the public products of that engagement with the museum and its collections, and I'd like to invite Frank to talk to us for a while, musing on this theme of history and imagination. Frank, thanks.
Thank you, Paul. Are we using the rostrum?
You can sit where you are, or you can stand.
Right, okay, fine. That's... the slides are more important, worth 10,000 words. yes, I suppose I was thinking that one of the questions that springs to mind is what is a fiction writer doing in a museum as a fellow? And it's great. It is a great sort of tribute in my estimation that the museum has invited a fiction writer into its hallowed treasures, into this temple of treasure, the Australian treasures. When I tell my friends that I'm a fellow at the museum, they say, "Are you in a glass case?" Do people come and watch you? Do children poke you with their finger? The security guards, I in fact work in the Centre for Historical Research, which is a new centre which Peter has been brought here to run, and we're in a building up that way, one of the old hospital buildings, and the security guards patrol the whole of this area, and they have a patrol sort of program timetable, and they come by my window at a certain time. In my office up there, and they wave to me. So I feel I am in a glass case for the security people. They now know who I am. They smile at me. As Peter says, I have published two novels, Grand Days and Dark Palace, which, through a character, an Australian woman, Edith Campbell Berry, uses the League of Nations from 19... League, remember, was the first attempt at international organisation that the world had ever tried. It was it was set in Geneva, and the League of Nations was the forerunner of the United Nations. Edith Campbell Berry is an Australian woman who goes there because she wants a career in diplomacy, and that seems to be the only place that she could possibly do that. Edith III, which is the third volume of this trilogy, continues Edith's story after the collapse of the League of Nations. The League of Nations officially closed down in 1946. Curiously, for a while we had the United Nations and the League of Nations both in existence for about a year. The UN was set up in 1945. Then the League handed over all its property and files to the newly formed United Nations. My character, Edith Campbell Berry, returns to Australia to live in Canberra in the 1950s. And the story, the new novel, is in part the struggle to establish a new capital in the bushlands of Australia, and its attempt to evolve an aesthetic which is dignified and at the same time functional, and in a especially Australian way, with no grandiose buildings that we might find in other cultures, but with a special Australian style. And she becomes fascinated with the idea that we are attempting to build a very special designed city, which in fact is now is virtually complete, has been completed virtually with, I think, the building of the new Parliament House, and virtually every major institution is now in place. Canberra is very close to being finished, completed, and now. And I think that, but don't get me started on this, I think it's a remarkable, we've achieved it, a remarkable thing in Australia of producing this aesthetically pleasing and triumphal capital. I know a little bit about the problems of some of the problems of Canberra, but it's a remarkable achievement that Australia, and sometimes I think, my God, how did we pull it off? How did we actually create this city from nothing and do it so well? It's a tribute to, I think, to not only genius in the case of, say, Burley Griffin, but it's also a tribute to something that never gets a tribute, is the intelligence, the combined intelligence and good judgment of committees. And the committees never get praised, but I'm praising them now. And I think in many ways, Australia, the capital city, is an example of the good judgment of many, many, many committees and many, many people who argued and fought and worried and dreamed about Canberra. It's a dream come true. So in many ways, this is where I come into the museum. basically, I deal the novel as. Remember that the novel is in not even midstream. But I'm working on it still, and it will be at least a year or more, probably 2 years before it's finished. So. But as I said when I was talking to Peter about it, that it was an examination of Australian aesthetics, mood and thought in those immediate post-war years of the 1950s, and that I would try to somehow expose myself to the collection here, but what I've realised is that the most important thing is that I expose myself to the curatorial staff, which the collection often doesn't exist until it comes out of the mind of a curator. It was part of my application was that I sent a chapter from Grand Days, which is called Mrs. Dickinson's Chair. This is a chapter in the book where this is back in in the mid-30s, when the League of Nations had decided to hold an international competition, just like Canberra, and to build the Palace of Nations. And this was to be the headquarters of the League of Nations. It was the first building that the world ever owned in common. I mean, it was the first time we ever owned a building as a planet. And this was this building, the Palace of Nations, was completed in 1936. What happened was that it captured the imagination of the world. Nation states, Australia was the first nation state to actually offer gifts to the Palace of Nations, to the League. And this was an extraordinary, spontaneous thing. No, this was not part of the deal. No, this wasn't. There wasn't an appeal for these sorts of things. Quite on the contrary, the architects had designed everything inside the building. They had made all sorts of rules about how the interior should be dealt with and designed. And the last thing they wanted or expected was that countries would start contributing things. Australia, we stole the game, surprisingly. This was Joe Lyons. But I don't know, actually, the thing I can't... the question I should be able to answer, but I can't, is who actually came up with the idea that we should send something there? What we did, we sent a podium and all the wall behind the General Assembly. So, I mean, we virtually got the two key pieces of Australian, of the whole machinery of the League of Nations was from Australia. And the podium and the backing was all in various Australian timbers. Probably wouldn't get away with that now. So we were the first, and then Norway, Sweden, and Denmark, and every other country contributed a room and started to put furniture, send across examples of their furniture. In the book, citizens then started sending in things. People designed flags for the League of Nations, which didn't have a flag until very late in its history. It was worried about having a flag because it made it look like a nation state. Only nation states had flags, and they worried. They had a committee on this for many years. The League of Nations, but people sent in designs and examples of clothing that the judges of the World Court should wear, and what the uniform of the international soldiers should wear, and what robe the president should wear, and so on. People flooded it with gifts, and there is a warehouse of these gifts. But remember that the architects had already decided there should be no paintings on the walls, there should be no embroidery, but basically they bowed to the idea of national rooms. And there was one mural commissioned in the council. I came across a file when I was over in Geneva for a number of years. And in France, researching the archive of the League of Nations, about three years or more there, on and off, but 1 year full time. This was going through the files, and I found the files were informing my work in a quite electrical way. I couldn't wait in the morning to get into the archives. One of the files I came across was Miss Dickinson, and she was running. She was an English woman up in Serbia running an orphanage for children who were made who lost their parents in the First World War, and she was running this orphanage. She had the children, or the children came up with the idea that they would design a chair for the president of the assembly of the League of Nations. And they worked on this for 2 years. The children carved it in Serbian monumental imperial style, and put their hearts into this. And the chair, Miss Dickinson wrote to the League of Nations, to the General Secretary, and said that the chair was finished, and she'd like the children to come to Geneva with it. And in fact, this went against the policy of the League. The League had to have uniformity in its chairs or every other piece of furniture, unless it came through a nation state. The League of Nations could only talk to nation states. It couldn't talk to individuals. All the individual letters were not answered. There's some sad stories that I could tell about that. But essentially, it's part of its covenant was that it could only deal with nation states. So it couldn't deal with some orphans up in Serbia. And the correspondence simply went into the file. The chair eventually found its way to Geneva and ended up in the ILO. But it had another little bit of history, and it ended up in the museum of the League of Nations. If you ever go to Geneva, you can go through the Palais, the Palace of Nations, and there's a museum. So this chair, I have my character in this chair, and it's an illustration. I read this file and my heart sort of stopped when I read about this wonderful chair. And in the book, my character, in fact, gets the chair into the League of Nations by forging. And this is where imagination takes over. She forges which is against every principle that she holds. She forges the General Secretary a Secretary General's signature on a letter accepting the chair into the League. It came in through even though there was no Edith Campbell-Berry who signed this letter, informal influences got the chair into the, at least to the warehouse. But and then I read in the file that the children had written, a plaque had been made and it had been placed under the chair, under the chair, indicating that it came from these orphans from the First World War. I thought, God, where is that chair now? And I went and asked the archivist, and he said, I think that chair is in the museum, and it's found its way into the museum. And I went in there, and there it was. And I got down on my hands and knees and looked under it. I lay down on the floor and looked under it, and there was the plaque saying, from the orphans of this school. And there the chair was. It had never been used. The file, of course, had never been opened since 1931 or something, too. No one had ever read this file. No one ever would. But there were many files that were like this and that caused me to create a chapter. At one point, I rang my publisher in London and said I thought that we should change our tack, and instead of me writing these books, that we should start to, I would select files and we would publish the files. And I remember him saying, I think you should take a break. Take a break.
And so will we. Thank you, Frank. That was nicely segued. And if you want to read the chapter, it's The Accepting of Gifts, Miss Dickinson's Chair, here in Grand Bays. Frank, we need to move on to Lenore, but there are many themes there that we'll pick up in discussion and with the company generally. Mm-hmm. Can I introduce Dr. Lenore Coulthart? Lenore's a political historian who's taught at several universities for about 25 years and then moved to Canberra, where she worked for the National Archives of Australia as research coordinator, and now she's retired for the second time and is working freelance as a heritage consultant. She's been working on a biography of the Australian socialist feminist Jessie Street for many years and is in the final throes of completing that biography. It was the reason why Lenore's here is that it was while working on Australian Women and the League of Nations, while she was senior lecturer in history at Adelaide, when Grand Days appeared, and I'm sure that Lenore will tell this story, so I will merely say that a friendship with Frank flowered as a result of the conjunction of those interests. And it's led to a relationship with Frank to this day, and this conversation is only the most recent product of it. So, Lenore, could I ask you to talk to us for some minutes about your interest in fiction and history? Thanks.
Thank you, Peter. Yes, it's perfectly true. I was writing a history of Australian women's involvement in the League of Nations in 1993 when I was at the University of Adelaide. And to my horror, saw that this new Frank Morehouse novel was about to appear and that the central character was an Australian woman at the League of Nations. And my fury knew no bounds. that my topic had been stolen, a topic that no one in the world could possibly think was interesting except me. I decided, as one does, that I would get a review copy of the book and I would write a review that would make me feel better. So I did get a review copy of the book and I did read it and I did publish a review of it. But it was a very different review than I thought I was going to write. I did think this, a work of fiction, could only trivialise the role of women in the League of Nations. And then, like so many readers of Grand Days and Dark Palace, I was absolutely captivated by the fictional character Edith Campbell-Berry, based, as Frank has said, on a real person, but not an Australian, of the League of Nations. So as a result of that, I think Frank and I had a conversation about that review at an Adelaide Writers' Festival probably early in 1994. And as a result of it, my own research trip, which I was had been planning for 1994, took on quite a difference. I'd worked out a way. I was going to Geneva. I was going to work in the League of Nations archives. through Frank and Frank's contacts there, I was able to actually get a flat from someone at the United Nations who was on mission and able to stay there almost 3 months, much longer than I would have otherwise. Plus, Frank gave me all these very useful tips, like which bus to get and to get an orange pass for the train and not to buy any food in Geneva but to go over the border to Ferney-Voltaire in France and the market on Saturday morning on the bus, all of which I dutifully followed. But I still, when I was working at the League of Nations Archives in the Palais des Nations, and also when I went to New York to work in the United Nations Archives, I was still writing a work of history about Australian women in the League of Nations. Now, if anyone wants to take on this topic, they're totally welcome to all the boxes of files that I still have about this topic and as a result of that research, because something happened to me as a result of Edith Campbell-Berry. I blame her. I did, instead of publishing the book that I was writing, I published a piece on Edith Campbell-Berry called The Idea of Edith Campbell-Berry. And I, after giving a talk on that at the Menzies Australian Studies Centre in London. And I had a problem then writing the kind of book that I thought I was writing. It started to seem terribly heavy and the kind of very impressive thing that a political historian would do, you know, leaving nothing out. Like every woman that ever had anything to do with the League of Nations, there were quite a few, was going to have everything about her dealings, influence and achievements included in this book. Fortunately, I decided that this was very... I realised this was very boring and I stopped being interested in it. And as a result, I took early retirement as an academic and thought, I can't write like this. I have to write so that I'm communicating more directly the thing I want to say, and not writing to impress the person looking over my shoulder, which I'm sorry to all the academics in the room, but I felt at that stage not only was I doing that, but I was actually teaching my graduate students to do it as well, and I wanted to stop. This is Edith's fault. I moved to Canberra and was offered a job at the National Archives and immediately took it because I thought, I'm an historian and I'm in the toy shop. It's absolutely wonderful, and it was a tremendous experience working at the National Archives. Frank referred to the important role of committees, and you know, committees kind of look boring, don't they? They sound boring, but committees do have a very important role. Committees sound as boring as files, government files, and the functions of government. Yes, these things look boring, and they are the most fascinating and powerful things we have. So, in the National Archives, with the files of federal government, the record of the functions of government for Australia's first 100 years was kind of a dreamland, especially for someone who didn't any longer want to include absolutely everything, because that's a real problem when you get into files if you do want to include everything. So I'd say, you know, my first Edith's effect and then the National Archives effect was very big. And I realised that instead of writing about everything, I would write about one thing. I would write about one woman who'd been at the League of Nations and who'd also been involved with the United Nations. And this would enable me to show something that I think is tremendously important, and that is the humanitarian work that was achieved by the League of Nations, which became the foundation of the human rights work of the United Nations. And because the League of Nations was seen as a failure, it didn't prevent the Second World War, the separation, which Frank draws so vividly in Dark Palace, was complete. There was seen as being no connection. So the legacy of all of those people and all of those women that I know so much about and I'm never going to do anything with was lost. It just became an invisible hole in history. So I thought, I'll choose one of them, Jessie Street, and I'll try and show how this happened. Now, that was fine up until about 2002, when Jessie Street's family, knowing that I was writing about her, commissioned me to produce a revised edition of her autobiography that was published in 1966. She died in 1970. I was advised by anyone who knew anything about this book not to touch it. and that was my own inclination too. It was written towards the end of Jessie Street's long life, And it was written at a point where she had started the illness that she suffered in her later years, dementia, had started to take hold. She wrote that book as a matter of public duty, and at the great argument of her friends and former colleagues to put something on record about her amazing work. And she tried to do that. But when you read the book is very repetitive, it's not, there's no chronological structure, it's all those bad things. And two important things. She didn't have a research assistant when she was writing it, and her memory was failing. And she had great difficulty finding a publisher, and eventually it was produced by the Australasian Book Society as a kind of left-wing favour, without the benefit of a publisher's editor. Now, we all know, as writers, that researchers and publishers' editors are your angels. And Jessie Street didn't have either. So I decided that I would take this commission from the family to produce a revised edition of the book because I'm a good researcher and because I'm a good editor. And I put a great big photograph of Jessie Street, my favourite photograph of her, her 1945 passport photograph, over my desk. And I talked to her. And I talked to her as I would have if she'd been around and I'd been her researcher when she was doing this book. And I talked to her very sternly, as I would have if I'd been her publisher's editor when she wanted her very messy manuscript published. And I tried to get the voice. I tried to give the book structure. I made it into chapters, and I took out the repetition. And I started to correct the many, many errors of date and name and the what our memories do when they start to fail us. They knit up the gaps wrongly. Beware of the memory that's doing this. So that experience made me realise that I was needing to listen to someone who was actually becoming a person in my life. At the time I said, I'm channeling Jessie Street, but I stopped saying it very quickly when I saw people's looks. But I did talk to her, and she did help me. And the final result, people were very happy with. Then something else happened. That was 2004 when that was finished. And I realised I didn't want to write an historical book about Jessie Street's role in the human rights legacy of the United Nations. I wanted to write about this woman. I wanted to bring her back to life. And I realised what I was doing was transforming my messy manuscript into a biography. Now, luckily, there are some very good historians around who've made this transition or are in the process of making this transition. And with the fellowship at ANU in the research school, I was able to work with some of those people, and that was a tremendous help to me. But sadly, Frank's influence and the many conversations with Frank and Edith's influence hadn't stopped this process, because as well as learning to hear a voice from a dead person, to ghostwrite for a dead person, I realised I was actually starting to listen to objects. I'm so glad Frank talked about Miss Dickinson's chair, because objects tell stories. Some objects talk, some of them speak softly, some of them sing, and I think some things dance. This is a problem for a historian. It's especially a problem for someone who's involved in the heritage area, or is it? Because things talk to me. And I realise it's the desire of the imagination for this connection to happen. And that it has nothing to do with a lack of reverence for the past and a lack of reverence for evidence. It has everything to do with what the imagination can do that overcomes that problem of trying to knit up gaps in our past memory or what we know of the past. The imagination takes us somewhere beyond the fallacy that you can get into if you're trying to knit up gaps. And I think that imagination is what gives the past a future. And as you can easily see, I'm very indebted to Frank for his friendship, for his fiction, and like so many other readers of Grand Days and Dark Palace, I'm dying for the third volume, the Canberra volume, but I hope I've finished my Jessie Street biography by then so that I can be inspired into some brand new field.
Thanks very much for it all. Thank you very much. Now, what I'd like to do now is to get these two talking to each other. And I was delighted that Frank introduced Miss Dickinson's chair, because I happen to know that there is a slide of a chair. And with your permission, I'd like you both to talk about this chair and the things that have emerged since Frank arrived at the museum. This hasn't been prearranged at all. This is an entirely spontaneous gesture. But I happen to know that this slide was here. So please, would you like to, between you, tell the story?
Well, I'll tell the first bit, will I?
Yes, please.
Because Lenore has a deep knowledge. Letting a writer loose in the treasures of the nation was a very bold move by Peter and the committee. One of the great privileges I have is to go to the warehouses, which the warehouses are in Mitchell and contain many, many thousands of treasures, from Bob Menzies' Bentley, which I was allowed to get in and sit in as long as I wore rubber gloves and wore white gloves and white trousers and hair net. But I was allowed to sit in it, and I looked. I know you want to know this. I looked for the bar, whether there was a bar in that Bentley that pulled out from the back seat, but there wasn't. Mm-hmm. If there was, I couldn't find it. It was secret, probably required a secret switch. And one of the things that I went through, there were old school of anatomy, there were something like 1,000 body parts in glass jars, and that have been found their way into the museum. some have lost their label, but because they were in a fire, I think, and the water washed the labels off. We were strolling through these warehouses after thousands of items, and I came across these chairs, the curator who was with me said that they thought these were from the lodge. And I had a look at them. They took the covers off. And I said, my God, they are. They're from the lodge. These are from the lobby of the lodge. What is the correct name for the...
Well, entrance hall.
Entrance hall.
Yes.
The entrance hall of the lodge. And I said they were there in 1927, because I've seen the photographs, and the Bruce was the Prime Minister at the time, and the Bruces were the first people to live in the lodge. The furniture I knew through Lenore was designed by Ruth Lane Poole, who was the official furniture designer for the Capitol. She designed the furniture for the lodge and for the Government House. And I said, my God, they're Ruth Lane Poole's chairs. And they'd been labelled dining room, and I said no, they're from the entrance hall, and there are photographs of these, and so we were able to, and I said we've got to get Lenore in to have a look at these, and then there was also a mirror, a Chevelle mirror. So I became very excited about this because it was a connection. These were in a sort of limbo. There were other pieces of furniture too from the old lodge. On them the label was pasted on them, discard. This has been pasted on the furniture back in the days when each Prime Minister's wife is allowed to renovate the lodge, and at some point these had been taken out of the lodge because the Prime Minister's wife wanted different furniture. And they'd been put in a public works storehouse, and then eventually they decided to discard them. These were designed by Ruth Lane Poole. And I said, God, this is not the museum that's discarding them. I'll turn you over to Lenore now, when the museum looked at its records, it found that they were, in fact, in 78, or was it? 78, they were advertised for sale with a lot of other old furniture from the public works. and from the public buildings. And at the last moment, someone said, "My God, they're important chairs. They were in the first lodge." So they were pulled off the auction list at the last moment. And then they ended up in a roundabout way in the museum.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so it was very exciting. Frank, this is one, yes. Frank phoned me and said, "I think I've found the Ruth Lane Poole chairs." And I was very sceptical because this has been a search for a while. And in fact, we had talked about trying to set up a kind of team of detectives, you know, to comb antique stores and secondhand stores and where had this stuff gone? It's perfectly true that prime ministerial wives, and indeed the same thing is true of Government House, because the Ruth Lane Poole designed the interiors there too, also opened in 1927. And the change, just taking the furniture out and putting it away, meant that some of it wasn't actually retrieved. So there is a whole household full of Ruth Lane Poole furniture from the lodge, and a whole household, very large household, full of Ruth Lane Poole furniture and furnishings from Government House that are public assets, to say the least, and objects that will talk, sing and dance for us that are their whereabouts are unknown. If you go to an open day at Government House, there's four or five things that are actually on their inventory list that they don't connect them to her. The research needs to be done so that everyone knows this. But the museum has the four chairs from the entrance hall, so maybe just have the other slide, Helene. Thank you. So this photograph was actually taken in 1930, and the reason I know that is because of the position of the grandfather clock. And the Bruces were the first, Stanley Melbourne Bruce and Ethel Bruce, the first occupants of the lodge. And when Bruce lost government and his seat in 1929, James Scullin became Prime Minister, and because of the Depression as Labor Prime Minister and because he'd objected to the expense of the lodge, wouldn't live in it. It's actually a very interesting story about where he did live in the Hotel Canberra. And apparently Sarah Scullin, his wife, took lots of the silver and various other bits from the lodge to actually decorate their suite or use in their suite at the Hotel Canberra. But of course, you know, they were seen to be being abstemious by not living in the lodge. The problem was that something had to happen with the lodge, so it was actually let. It was advertised for rent. And this photograph was taken in 1930 to appear in the Australian Home Beautiful magazine that Ruth Lane Poole wrote for, with an advertisement for those people who were interested in renting the lodge. Because Ruth Lane Poole specified that clock was actually on the other side of the staircase, and there is a photograph that shows it on the other side of the staircase, but at some point it was moved over there, and this photograph was taken to show how beautiful the lodge was. So there you can see exact chair that we just saw. There are four of them. Actually, the one over there is the one we just saw. There are four. Two have arms and two don't.
That's right.
Stanley Melbourne Bruce touched these chairs. I said to Frank, he sat in them. I thought, well, maybe he didn't, but maybe he flung his spats at them, or maybe he tossed his top hat on them, or maybe he just brushed past them. But I made sure. I was very careful. But when I was taken to see that chair in the repository, the chairs in the repository, I made sure I kind of just brushed past a little bit too for the connection, and I listened as hard as I could. It's a tremendously exciting find, and it means
we have to find the clock and that table.
We do. The clock is particularly interesting. There is a grandfather clock in the repository, and we were shown this, but when you get a good photograph like this, you can see it's not exactly the same grandfather clock. But I know when the grandfather clock was moved out of the lodge and who moved it out, and it was Patty Menzies in Menzies' second term in office, because she found it so lonely at night in the lodge with the ticking of the clock so loud, she asked to have it taken out.
Lenore, you used the phrase the desire of the imagination, and you've just given a perfect example of it where the chair isn't just a chair, it's a chair which has associations with people. Yes. In this case, a real person, but equally the fictional characters whom Frank will populate 1950s Canberra with as well. Can I ask, each of you represent, if you like, a real and a fictional character. Frank's great character is Edith Campbell Berry, whom those of us who've read these two novels really warm to and are desperately keen to know what happens to her in the third volume. And you, of course, are the living embodiment, in fact, of Jessie Street, having channeled her through the manuscript. What would happen if these two women of the Australia in the 1930s had met? Have you speculated at all about that, about their different characters and different political perspectives?
First of all, I have to say, I don't think I'm the embodiment of Jessie Street, but it is a very interesting thought. Maybe we'll look at the other slide. And Jessie Street is second of the alive people in this photograph. She's second from the right in the front with the cloche hat and the white shirt. There are actually many other people we know in this photograph. Betty Archdale is there, and I think that's Betty Archdale next to Jessie Street. Her mother, Helen Archdale, is the statuesque woman without the hat, the only one without a hat. The woman here in the front holding her bag with the fur collar is Alice Paul, famous...
This woman here,
Alice
the
Paul.
Large woman.
No, no, the
one
woman
next to her.
Next to her.
Right.
Large woman is a German delegate. Alice Paul is the slim woman with the fur collar. Big fur
anyway.
Collar. She is... yes, so 1938... Palais des Nations, you can see how absolutely elegant it is. And these women are international delegates of women's organisations who are there for the General Assembly of the League. And a photograph like this really does give you an idea of how extraordinary this time was between the wars. Okay, now we can imagine somewhere inside the building is Edith. Jessie walks in and they meet each other. Okay, Frank?
Yeah, you're the novelist.
If I were rewriting the book, I would have Jessie Street in it. Yeah. I mean, I couldn't. I'd be in a lot of trouble if I didn't put Jessie Street in, but I hadn't yet.
But
some other
different
delegates from Australia were in the book.
Yes.
Every year we sent delegations, usually because of the expense, if anyone was overseas, any professor, any scientist, no writers wouldn't be allowed. Any politician who was in Europe would be raked into the delegation.
That's a fascinating encounter to speculate on. Now, at this point, I would like to open it up to our audience, because you've come along, and here's a golden opportunity to interrogate two practitioners of the two arts that we're interested in. I was very interested that this series has been couched, and Kirsten's at the back, couched this series as history and imagination, not as historical fiction. There's a big discussion going on in various places at the moment, most recently in Quarterly Essay, when Inga Clendenin wrote a piece called Who Owns the Past, and she got stuck into historical novelists pretty drastically. So clearly there's some bone of contention between historians and historical novelists. And all of us read history and read fiction. So I would hope that we've all got questions or points to make. So please, put your hand in the air, tell me your first name, and address the question via the microphone that Helena will give you. Thank you.
My name is Robin, and given what you said about the importance of imagination, I'm interested to ask you how much you think even history itself is imagination.
I'm a great believer in the evidence. I'm a great believer in the files and the objects. I think that I'm not a writer of fiction, so I don't have the ability to do what I'd like to do with your question. I think we need to understand that communicating history is part of the process. And it's really hard to communicate to many people weighty evidence with no imagination in it. I think it's very interesting now that we have some very good films made that have historical basis, but clearly the filmmaker, the camera person, those who are visualising the scenes can't have been there, so it's coming out of their imagination. That's an extraordinary, powerful way to get across the historical story. I'm thinking of things like, for instance, that wonderful film series of the Lewis and Clark expedition in the USA, where the whole film came out of the letters and reports that Lewis and Clark sent back to Jefferson, who'd commissioned them to do this. That the paper reports, you know, they didn't take photographs, they didn't do anything like that, and yet this astonishing filmic communication was made out of it. I feel I'm kind of sidestepping your question, Robin, because I'm a little nervous about answering it. I'm a political historian, so I can't make things up, but I now can't write to the denial of my imagination either.
What? Of course, this you've hit the most, if you like, interesting and contentious part of the whole process that we're here talking about, is exactly what it is, this thing called the imagination. What is this? What is the imagination? When Peter read out my introduction, the note that I have in both books about how I used resources and sourced material and have fictional and non-fictional people clearly identified, and then I had that line at the end saying, but above all, it's a work of the imagination. Whenever I read that or hear it, as I did today, I think, oh my God, it's curious that this is not a very clearly defined human capacity. It's a function of intellectual function. It's a capacity. There's very little written about its psychological nature as a process. I see it as a tool of inquiry. It's a way of. It's a search engine. It uses many pathways. Of course, it draws on. It actually is an informed imaginary. In my case, there are lots of different ways of approaching fiction historically. But I can only talk. That in my case, that I did use a lot of research because I found that enriching. I mean, it wasn't just an obligation. It wasn't an intellectual obligation alone, although I saw it as a bit of an obligation, but it was also dynamic. The imagination also draws on, but that all historians draw on the documents and photographs and objects that we've been talking about, objects. But the imagination also draws on, obviously, on the unconscious, if you accept a Freudian interpretation of the structure of the mind, and the unconscious is an archive. All our unconsciousnesses contain, if you they're like a wax cylinder of whispered conversations we heard as children, arguments we might have heard as children, buildings we've seen, and so on, objects we've sat in, or built, towns we've visited, and that there is this. In working with the imagination, that the construction, the process of actually writing sets up a pathway to the unconscious. Other things that the imagination works with is intimacy, which is a tool. Intimacy is a very powerful tool of knowing. That's how we know about another person deeply, is through intimacy. And empathy as a sort of more general term for connection with others and the observation of others. So that it's interestingly enough that an imagination has often been imbued with spiritual or supernatural qualities. Yeats and poets love to invest it with being a gift and a special gift. And for a long time, you know, there was the creator. The only two creative acts were God and the poets. But now we know that we all have imagination. That's why how we can tell lies. I mean, every time we tell a lie, we're using the imagination. We alter, and but the actual integrity of the imagination as a tool of inquiry and its credibility depends hugely on the impact, the exposure that imagination's had to the material it's working with, and and of course to the particular special talents of any given fiction writer. Mm. So there, that is assessed. I mean, my books have to be argued about by historians as well as general readers and people who've had, and most of us have had access to some of this period, the 30s and 20s, through our parents and grandparents.
Mm.
But there's a lot to be said about the amount, but it is an understudied capacity, human intellectual capacity, I think.
Thank you. Thank you. Tell us who you are. And
my name is Anne, and I'm interested in whether what role you think the historical imagination plays in helping us appreciate our past, and in contributing to that role, does it matter that there it is not strictly factual, you know, the role of the imagination and fact?
Mm, thank you. Yeah.
Some things it does matter, I think, very seriously matter in terms of my method, that I think there are some things that I desperately want to get correct. And it seems to me there was no point in inventing some things like, well, obviously chronologies and dates that conferences, historical events that are without doubt, you know, that things started then and finished then. The League of Nations finished in a date in 1946. But essentially, things that seem to me to matter should be grounded somewhere.
The things you call substantial in your note to the reader.
Yes, substantial. Yeah. But of course, the archives are so rich. It's like the National Archive for. I think Lenore said this. It's like a castle of sleeping stories. I mean, it's a castle full of. I've worked there, and you just quite often just want to turn around and say, "Hey, to the rest of the room, come over and look at this." So there is a, and then as I say, the act of the imagination is obviously to create a narrative, and to produce a engagement with the material, the historical material, and this engagement. Comes out of storytelling, and well, religions, I mean, are all narratives about why we're here and what we're doing and where we're going. These are narratives, and they're sacred narratives for some people.
It seems that they connect at the level of selection. Lenore talked about the National Archives as a toy shop where you were in your element, and Frank, you've also talked about the riches of the archives that you spend not just a day or two, and you spend months in imbibing detail and digesting the sources. And it seems that the thing that connects you both in that is the whole principle of selection, that selection for significance in the case of the historian, and perhaps selection for the narrative, for the plot, for the novelist. But you want to get the detail right, but you want to get it right for the purposes of your plot. And that both of you are selecting things, although possibly on a different basis. I don't know.
I'm glad that Frank brought up the unconscious before, and especially just before Anne's question, because in a sense, writing history is like writing fiction in that you unfortunately discover more about yourself, more than you might want to know. Mm. And the place of, you can be very selective about the facts you're looking for, even when you think you're being a completely comprehensive and totally evidence-based historian. Mm. And it catches you out. In a way, the imagination helps save this or maybe allows you to understand it, because you're unconscious and you're more aware of the role of your unconscious. I'm thinking here of a particular story, an argument that I had with Sebastian Clark, who I went to school with for 1 year at Ainslie Primary School, and who, when I met him years and years later, when I was back in Canberra, greeted me with, "Yes, I remember you. We were editors of the school magazine in 1951. And I said, "No, we weren't." And he said, he is a mathematician, I'm a historian. I said to him, "I'm the one who's right. You know, you can't possibly remember this better than I would know, you know." But I was sort of puzzled enough about why he said it was called Ainsleeves, and that his mother, Dimfner, had actually thought of the name, but he remembered very clearly that he'd reported this name at school and everyone was so thrilled with it that he took the credit for it, and Dimfner had a bit unhappy with him. So I thought, if he remembered that, you know, am I mis-? So the next time I was in the National Library, I did check and found the 1951 first edition of the school magazine with, on the bottom of the front cover, editors Sebastian Clark and Lenore Coulthart. And I was completely shocked, but the minute I saw this, remember that old kind of Xeroxing, gestetnery sort of stuff? The minute I saw that porous paper with that kind of ink soaked into it, I could smell it. I could smell turning the handle. And I knew that he was right. And so I had to, I got a photocopy copy for him and a photocopy copy for me, and I very humbly presented it to him and said, "You're absolutely right." And I know that's because somebody who really loves the facts is loves being dogmatic too, and loves being right.
Yes, please.
My name's Bruce. Could I just ask you both to comment perhaps on how imaginative do you think is the making of the Australian nation? I ask that partly because in the first two volumes of Frank's trilogy, it seems to me that the comparative act, the act of comparison, is very important. And also accident seems very important. And I'm just wondering how they fit into notions of any unique nationalism or the creativity of making a nation.
That's a big question too. That's I think it was Cézanne that said was in some sort of Parisian discussion, and he was asked a question and he said, "Do you have any smaller questions?" Any smaller questions. But I'd expect it from your mind. One of the things about the imagination, and I was trying to describe its capacities, and they're not all imaginations are equal, and not all imaginations succeed in their when working within the constructions of forms, traditional forms like the novel or the short story, whatever. But ultimately, the one thing we share with academic historians is that our work is a hypothesis. This is, from my work and my mind and my talents, this is how I think it happened, and I think this is how it works and how it worked. And that this is that is probably what I mean by ultimately a work of the imagination, is that ultimately it's a hypothesis, and this was an effort to imagine to the elite.
I want to have a go at that big question. I like little ones too, but it made me think, Bruce, that it depends who's doing the making of the nation, how imaginative it is. Because when you said that, my first thought was, standing at Abiri Rock and looking at the amazing tens of thousands of years old artwork there, and that making of Australia, that the imagination in that making of Australia, which non-Indigenous Australians are now turning to in understanding the making of Australia today. And the idea of comparison and accident, I think a terrific thing is when we realise that it's real people who create those files. They touched them, they signed them, they were sitting in the chair. And we live our lives in this way. You know, we live our lives because of accident, being late, you know, running into a tree, whatever it is, boiling the milk over in the morning. And being absorbed in the work in a way that the real people are coming out of it is actually being attentive to the role of coincidence, accident, comparison.
Yeah.
I have a nice thought. Oh, we take another question.
No. All right, we'll take another question. Yeah.
About that.
There's one over here. Please, wait for the microphone.
I might come back to Bruce.
Yeah, sure.
I don't think I'll be there.
My name is Kamala. I have a very small question. Often when I read historical novels, I feel the writer takes too much of poetic license, creates his own imagination and puts it into the book and calls it a historical novel. But at the same time, I've read novels where the writer doesn't have too much imagination and depends a lot on history, and the book falls flat.
Mm.
So what is the optimum, you know, blend?
You call that a small question. Yes, it's a matter of incorporating, marrying the imagined work and the factual. There are academics here who, anyone, not only academics, but that even using the word factual is disputed and contested, let alone nation building and national images and so on. So that in a sense everything is a hypothesis. We're waiting, more information floods in. There's a biography of a guy called Lytton Strachey that's been written three times by Holroyd. Holroyd's written it three times because more information keeps being released into the world. Mm. But marrying those together is a matter of intuitive judgment by the storyteller, I think. I was going to answer Bruce further about nation building because it's one of my favourite stories. And that when I was researching Dark Palace and Grand Days, I was living in France and... as well as at first in Geneva and then nearby in France, in Besançon. And I was working with friends in a small village, French village, and we came to a patisserie, and in the patisserie there were the cakes were all out in the window and this wonderful French pastry. And I looked at them and I thought, oh my God. I said, isn't this marvellous? There's a Woodrow Wilson cake, and there's a Clemenceau cake, and there's a Aristide Briand cake. And I said, look, the French remember their history through the gastronomy. And they eat history every day, and they understand. And nation building is through gastronomy, and here we have. And I got so excited, we went in and talked to the woman who was running the shop in a white apron, flower story. and I praised her, and I said, this is wonderful, this is magnificent, that you have these memories, and I'm writing a book with these people in it, and now you have a cake shop with these people in it. And she said, c'est pas vrai. No, it's not true, sir. What you say, say pas vrai. It's not true what you're saying. And I just stared at her, and then she talked in French to my friends who could speak better French than I, and then I realised she was saying, no, you got it all wrong. The cakes are named after the streets of the village. So much for the grand French theory that I had about the French nationality.
Anyone else venture a question, big or small? On here.
As small as you can get. Was the lodge ever rented?
No one wanted it. No, it wasn't. It was set there. Canberra's White Elephant was the headline this morning.
Think of the revenue we've foregone for the last 11 years.
Yes. Immediately after, of course, after the Scullin government fell, it was very, very much lived in through the 1930s by the Prime Minister, described by a German Prime Minister at the time as the world's most child-rich Prime Minister. Yeah. So the Lions and their 10 children lived there.
More? I feel like an auctioneer because every now and then I see somebody scratch a nose or touch an ear. I thought, is that an itch or is it a question? But with my eyes, who knows? Look, I've had a very enjoyable and stimulating afternoon. It seems to me that I hope you've been taking notes because some of the things that Lenore and Frank have said have lodged in my mind. And talking about the intuitive judgments of storytellers, I think you said, Frank, you've pointed to similarities in the process. That although the products may seem very, very dissimilar, and the raw material, the form of the product is so different, the raw material is the same in many cases, And the value to the reader, I think, in the case of both the sorts of material you produce, is equally nourishing, possibly more nourishing than the cakes that you stumbled across, because the desire of the imagination, as Lenore called it, I think is to find a product that rings true. And in your different ways, you've both talked about and described work that helps us to understand history in a way that it rings true. Frank's history rings true, even though Edith Campbell Berry, sadly, did not really exist. And historians' work rings true because we recognise in it truths or insights into the human condition. So this is, I hope, the beginning of a stimulating series of conversations amongst different practitioners and amongst readers of the products of those practitioners, which I think will enrich us all as the year goes by. And I think there are three more conversations, are there not, Helena?
Yes. Okay. The next one is on the 24th of June, and that involves Libby Robin, an environmental historian, and Nick Dryson, a fiction writer from Canberra who wrote the book recently, Love and the Platypus. So okay. It should be really good.
Thank you. Well, with that foretaste of things to come, can I thank several people before I thank you. Helena for organising this, Kirsten for thinking of it, Sean and Noreen for the media operations technicalities that you haven't seen much of today, but lots of people will see this on the website as a result of their work, and Ticker and Lannan for their audiovisual contributions. But most of all, can I thank you all for coming along this afternoon, and particularly for bringing your curiosity and questions, and for making this event the success it has. And I hope to see you at future events. Thank you very much.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.